Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. I am, as always, your host, Matt Hipple, editor of the Next War blog and director of online content for SimSec. On this podcast, we talk a lot about strategy. Fine example, last week's episode with the Australian Strategic Policy Institute on Asian Game Changers. Heck, strategy's even in their name. But something that we don't talk quite a lot about is the way that strategy is created. Not the way that we discuss strategy and the way that we define our new strategies, but rather the way that we produce strategic literacy. Now, granted, this podcast is a fine example of a way to create strategic literacy. Just listen to us every week and tell all of your friends. But how do institutions do it? That should be an easy question to answer with today's guest. We will be joined by Rear Admiral James G. Fogo, Assistant Deputy Chief of Naval Operations for Operations, Plans, and Strategy. He sat down with us to talk about some of the ways the Navy is trying to build that strategic literacy. We discussed the upcoming Current Strategy Forum in June at the Naval War College. We also discussed his new subspecialty initiative, which is an attempt to identify and engage people that are interested in strategic thought within the United States Navy. We also hear some stories about interesting individuals who, during his career, encouraged and informed the interest and strategy that he has today. This and more after a short break.
Do you like Sea Control? Of course you do! We're your friends. You wouldn't want to disappoint your friends, would you? We are available on iTunes and Stitcher Stream Radio. Make sure to subscribe, leave a 5-star rating, and tell everyone you know, even the people you don't really know. They will appreciate it. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, and anyone who says otherwise is really just trying to keep the podcast to themselves. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
And welcome back. We are joined today, as I said, by Rear Admiral James G. Fogo, Assistant Deputy Chief of Naval Operations in N3N5. So this is an educational moment for everyone. N3N5, it's Navy speak. What does that mean? It's a staff coding structure that originated back in the late 18th century with General Napoleon and Berthy. Essentially, N3 means operations, and N5 means plans. So, Admiral Fogo is in charge of operations, plans, and strategy. Sir, thanks so much for joining us today.
Hey, Matt, let me tell you, I'm delighted to be here and participate in your Sea Control podcast. And personally, I laud you for doing this. I'm impressed with the reach that you have with both this podcast, also your blog, Next War, as well. And I follow your writings, and I think that what you provide to interested listeners and to the fleet is a kind of a virtual engine for dialogue and exchange of ideas that's so important to our Navy. So in two words, I just say Bravo Zulu.
And it is, of course, a team effort. So for all you listening from SimSec, all of our writers, our membership secretary and our director and everyone else, you know, this is a group effort, so I'm really glad that you're able to pull something from all of our materials. Now, at the beginning of every show, I'm sure you're used to having people read biographies that are about 5 minutes long before you get into a speech or a discussion. What we like to do here is give you the opportunity to talk about yourself for a quick moment, describe where you're coming from, your background, and what you think are the most important beats for people to understand in seeing your perspective and where you're coming from, sir.
Okay. Hey, I don't like long bios, so I'll just briefly summarize. I'm a 1981 graduate of the United States Naval Academy. I was a chemistry major, and what appealed to me about becoming a submariner when I went into that line of business was something that Admiral Rickover used to advocate, and that was I interviewed with him, and that was a very interesting experience, but he advocated for education for life, and it wasn't just about what you do in school or what you do in new school, that education continues throughout your life and that you should take a broad approach. So if you're an engineer, read about philosophy, and vice versa. If you're an English major or a language major, read about math and science, and continue to do that and strive for excellence throughout your life. I've tried to do that. I've had a kind of a regular path on shore duty for a submariner. I've been fortunate to command at all levels. I had the USS Oklahoma City, very proud of the command tour, and Submarine Squadron 6, and then Submarine Group 8 in Naples, Italy, during the Odyssey Dawn and Unified Protector campaign. And I'll talk a little bit about that later on. But I went to graduate school at the University of Strasbourg in France as an Olmsted Scholar, and I'll talk a little bit about those experiences too. And I found that to be an extremely broadening experience for me. And that experience and learning both French culture and language and seeing defense and strategic studies from their viewpoint opened a lot of doors for me later in my career. So I think that's about enough for an introduction.
Absolutely. The general topic, the bin that we were going to put this discussion in is the creation, cultivation, and dissemination of strategy. So we talk about strategy itself, but we don't talk as often about how the strategic literacy is created. And I thought we would start off with giving you the opportunity to introduce the current strategy forum. So you're very passionate about this. It's an opportunity for people to get together with academics, officers, JOs, mid-grade, flag from different services to talk about strategy, their ideas. So what's your concept for this conference, and what are you trying to get out of it? And discuss the value that you see in this kind of this forum setting for people to discuss strategy.
Okay, let me do that, and then you tell me when you want to cut me off or when you've heard enough and you want to move on to the next question, because I'll be very passionate about the current strategy forum. In brief, and not to be too technical, but, you know, we have an OPNAV instruction on this, and it's essentially the Secretary of the Navy's forum at the Naval War College. And we're very fortunate that the Secretary of the Navy has allowed Admiral Greenert and the President of the Naval War College, Rear Admiral Ted Carter's call sign Slapshot, who's a distinguished graduate of the class of 1991, a classmate and a good friend of mine, and N35, to kind of team up and really push the issue of strategy and strategists this year. So the current strategy forum will be held on June 17th and 18th of this year. We do it every year. Our theme is, as I said, strategy and strategists. And let me just tell you about some really accomplished authors that we've been able to bring in as our keynote speakers. First and foremost is the chief strategist in the Navy, Admiral Greenert, is going to kick it off with his keynote address on his view of strategy, the Navy, and a future cadre of strategists. Professor Lawrence Friedman of King's College in the United Kingdom, Sir Lawrence, has written a book called Strategy, A History. And I was first introduced to this book by my favorite periodical, and that's The Economist. I'd recommend everybody out there, if you're not reading it, read it. It's one of the best things on the market that comes out every week. And The Economist said that was the one of two of the best books of 2013. It's about 786 pages. I'm not advocating that you know, people buy it. I've read it, and I think it is fantastic from the standpoint of taking us from the very baseline of strategy. And he starts out talking about anthills, soldier ants versus, you know, the others that live in an anthill, on how colonies war on one another. And he takes you right through the history of warfare, even in the Bible. And, you know, Moses' strategy against the Pharaoh, the Peloponnesian Wars, the Great Wars, First World War, Second World War, the aspects of nuclear deterrence right up through present, and how we're in a more multipolar world now. Second guy we've got is Robert Kaplan, one of my favorite authors. I used to do Balkans on the Joint Staff. He's the author of Balkan Ghosts, and he's written a new book called Asia's Cauldron. It's all about the Western Pacific, South China Sea, and it lends itself exactly to our strategy of the rebalance to the Pacific. You may have seen him recently. He was on Fareed Zakaria's Global Public Square. He did a phenomenal job. And he talks a lot about the value of sea power. And he even speculates that through our forward presence, we can deter conflict out in the Western Pacific, which is exactly what we're doing. If there's a war out there, there's a remote possibility of a land war between North and South Korea. But he also quotes John Mearsheimer in saying, there's something to be said for the stopping power of water and how difficult this is for us to play the away game and for anybody who's a potential aggressor or adversary to, you know, maintain a logistics train that would allow naval operations against another one of our allies. Jeffrey Till is coming from King's College. He's written the definitive guide on sea power, a guide for the 21st century. And then another one of my favorites, and a young guy, Dr. Peter Singer, who wrote Wired for War, which is it's the Bible of the history of the development of drones and how drones have played a role in not just our strategy, but our national strategy. And you probably recall just after or just before his retirement, Admiral Stavridis had a controversial blog that said, hey, there's really a new triad out there, something to think about. And that new triad is cyber, soft, and drones. And that really is something that we can debate. At any rate, we're going to get together up at the War College with all the students, and we're going to bring in what I call some key influencers. These are, you know, our keynotes that I mentioned, the CNO, and then others like you noted Peter Swartz as one of the fathers of naval strategy, maritime strategy. He was integral and wrote the majority of the strategy in 1986 for Secretary Lehman and CNO Watkins. And we're going to bring these folks into the room where they can mix with War College students who are in the strategy program, the master's program in naval strategy, as well as, and with the Director of Navy Staff, Admiral Swift's assistance, you know, and he's a brilliant guy who was the 7th Fleet Commander, one of my favorite strategic thinkers in the Navy. He's reached out to all the numbered fleets and has invited some junior officers like you, Matt. You're coming to this thing. I love this stuff, you know, and that want to talk about this stuff and who will be there with the professors from the War College, the students from the War College who are about to graduate from this pilot program Admiral Carter has started in Masters in Strategic Naval Strategy, and the noted authors, the CNO, some others from the staff here. And we're going to have a day and a half of really deep discussions on grand strategy, naval strategy, and then how we formulate the what I call the strategic enterprise, how we cultivate people like you for the rest of your career to make sure that you are educated and that you're given experience tours that will matter later on when you become a commander and a captain and you come back to the building and you find yourself in a position where, you know, you're writing the next maritime strategy.
You had mentioned this in our prep for this interview. So we're talking about CSF. It's very structured in and of itself. So it's a form, it's a place, it's scheduled. It's somewhere where everyone's going. But something less structured, a way that we can inculcate strategy, strategic literacy, and curiosity in officers more regularly throughout their careers. And this is something that you were interested in. And you had mentioned something that you had described as a Blue Force Tracker. So a way, for those who don't know what that means, it's a way of tracking friendly forces. So you have people out there that are interested in strategy, that read about strategy, that write about strategy, and you, or at least have some sort of base knowledge, and you want to be able to track them or follow them in this or any other skills. And maybe if you could describe what your thoughts are on this concept, how you're going to go about it, and how you see operationalizing this in the officer career in the United States Navy.
Exactly. So you mentioned you know, the Army term, but I think it conveys well of Blue Force Tracker. What Admiral Carter has done at the War College this year for the first pilot program is created the Naval Strategist Program. There's two courses up there, a senior course and a middle-level course, the Nimitz course and the Spruance course. Basically, there's a core curriculum, but there are some professors who are noted strategists who teach elective courses that allow you to qualify for this Master's in Naval Strategy. And then on top of that, there's a 13-week capstone project that allows students to develop strategic projects or products that are tailored to the needs of the fleet and the combatant commanders. there's about, I think, 8 to 10 students in this program, some Navy and a couple of Army guys, as a matter of fact. At any rate, when they graduate from that program, first thing we'd like to do by bringing the junior officers into this discussion is show them the Naval War College and show them this curriculum and say, if you're serious and you like strategic studies, this is the place to go. Once we invest in this education, and I'll tell you it's education and not training, and I'll tell you a quick funny anecdote that I really like that illustrates this point, and that's back at the Naval Academy in 1981. I had a Royal Navy exchange officer named Commander Paul Haddix, who later became a hero of the Falklands. He finished the Falklands War and became a vice admiral. He was the deputy commander of the NATO military staff in Brussels. He's now Sir Paul Haddix. He was knighted. And I've kept in touch with him throughout the years. But when he was that Celestial Nav instructor, he'd come into class and he would say, well, I've been here at the Naval Academy for a couple of years now, and my constructive criticism of your program is that I'm a graduate of Dartmouth, our Naval Academy. And I think it's important that midshipmen be educated. And he said, at Dartmouth, he said, well, the reason why I think you need to be educated is because education is different than training. You must educate midshipmen because you can train a monkey to do anything, and it's not just about training. It's about this thing Rickover talked about, a lifetime of education. So he said, frankly, at Dartmouth, we educate our midshipmen, but here at the Naval Academy, I believe you train monkeys. So I'll start off every class with a history lesson, and it was usually a story about how the Brits had defeated us at sea in the Revolutionary War and War of 1812. And he was a great guy. He was humorous, but it illustrates the point of this is not about training at the Naval War College. It's about a year-long education with a master's degree in naval strategy. And once we've done that, once we've made that investment, what do we do with it? You've got to attach that Blue Force tracker to each of these individuals because they're going to leave the War College and they're going to go out to the fleet and develop their warfighting skills. We need to know where they are here at N35 so that when we call on the Bureau and NPC to give us a qualified body to do something like write a new maritime strategy, write an Arctic strategy, be part of the air-sea battle capstone project that's going on here in the Pentagon, we get the right fit for Phil in that billet. And so what we're proposing, and this is at the very fiducial level of discussions with our friends at the Bureau, is that we establish a subspecialty code. We got a number, 2300P, that's not really important, but each of those young men and women that get that degree would be recipients of this subspecialty code. And then when you go out in the fleet, the record is flagged. And when somebody like me says, hey, I got to have a fill for a very important strategic billet in N35 and in 512 or 513 plans of policy, then they can offer up, well, yeah, we've got a number of people, and here they are, and they're graduates of this program or another pole mill program that's equivalent. That's education and not training. And we can say, okay, well, at what level or point in their career are these people? In other words, I don't want to take somebody out of the cockpit of an F-18 if he's in the middle of his deployment or the middle of his tour as a department head. So we need a cadre of these folks that are in the fleet getting the proper level experience as warfighters and then able to come back to really important jobs here on the OPNAS staff, jobs with combatant commanders, with OSD, with numbered fleet commanders in those very important positions and staffs that require strategic thinkers. And they're everywhere. There's probably too many billets and not enough people. So we're starting, crawl, walk, run slowly and trying to build this cadre of folks that fit that bill.
This is a good stepping off point. The CNO mentions interdependency a lot, and you just finished up a few weeks ago at the Global 13 game, a C2 game involving, command and control game involving LCS and A2AD environment. Now, when we talk about interdependency, we're also talking about, I would say, interdependency with strategy. So air-sea battle, it's the Air Force, and that's the Navy. When you're talking about this strategic dialogue, how do you view or what do you see us doing in the Navy to cross-pollinate? So we have our friends at The Bridge. Nathan Finney's over there. There are a lot of Army bloggers that they're Army strategists, so... You know, finally we're going to get a strategist subcode. They get to be full-time strategists. But we have these guys in the Army. We have these guys in the Air Force. Everyone has their own strategy. You know, they're talking about Clausewitz over in the Army. And here in the Navy, we have Lieutenant Commander Armstrong as the modern-day godfather of writing on Mahan. So how do you see all this cross-pollination working out? At the CSF, you're inviting officers from other communities. Do you see a more regular way of doing this? So you're putting the Blue Force Tracker on folks out there in the fleet. Do you see us building more programs to engage them with their alternates in other services?
Yeah, I think the beauty of knowing where our maritime or naval strategic thinkers are and being able to tap them for some of these billets that I mentioned, and you're absolutely right, a billet in OPNAV 512 or 513 is a billet in a Navy staff, but it is here in the Pentagon, and the Pentagon is purple. If you go out to, however, a combatant commander or another service chief staff on an exchange program or an LNO program, or you go to a numbered fleet, many of those numbered fleet headquarters are associated with joint commands. If you look at Compact Fleet, which is not necessarily a numbered fleet, it's the father and mother of the numbered fleet in the Pacific, they're inextricably tied to PACOM. And so there's going to be that exchange, that purple exchange. Not only was I up at Global 13, and this goes beyond just service boundaries within our own national limits, for Global 13, we opened up the air-sea battle concept to Australia, Canada, the United Kingdom, and for the first time ever, to Japan, who is a very important partner, ally, and close friend. And so this goes to the coalition as well, serving overseas in places where strategic thinking is important as we mesh with our allies. Admiral Greenert has an article in the latest proceedings about the global network of navies. It's about how we do exchanges with our allies and partners, how we cultivate our allies and partners to be even better at what they do in this thing we call a network. You know, we went from a 1,000-ship Navy, a global maritime partnership, to a network, something that can be formed rapidly, like we did for typhoon relief in the Philippines, like we did for and are doing for the search for MH370. So these kind of folks that think this way are important. You know, we have a Coalition Force Maritime Component Command course, which is the curriculum is managed and is taught by the Naval War College, but not at the Naval War College. It's done in Naples, Italy. It's done in Bahrain, and it's done in Hawaii for our coalition partners and American officers and some other officers of other services who get together and talk about what it's like to be out there in the Western Pacific, in the Arabian Gulf, or in the Mediterranean, facing the kind of challenges that we have today.
Perfect. Now, we'll take a quick break, break it up for everybody, let them shake it off, and then we will be right back with Admiral Fogo.
Great content from the Center for International Maritime Security. Like the Sea Control podcast, it's at your fingertips. Go to www.cimsec.org. Make sure to check out our partners. Our friends at the Australian Strategic Policy Institute produce the Sea Control Asia Pacific edition. Our friends at the Phoenix Think Tank produce Sea Control East Atlantic. To get our articles and announcements by email, don't forget to sign up at www.simsec.org/about/membership. And hey, if you feel inspired, feel free to write us an article or two, or five. Join the discussion.
And we're back with Rear Admiral Fogo. Sir, one of the interesting things, we're talking about the cultivation of strategy. You're you and many of your peers are unique. So you commissioned in 1981. So we're looking at three decades, roughly, each that represents a different state of the international community. So from 81 to 89 to somewhere in the early 90s, it depends which IR instructor you talk to, that was the bipolar world. That was the Cold War. Then as a mid, so that was you from JO to mid-grade. From mid-grade to major command, you looked at America's unipolar moment, the Balkans, and then the beginning of the global war on terror. And now as a flag, you've seen an environment that many are describing as a reset to a multipolar world. So throughout this, I'm sure that there's been a lot of friction between folks in old models and folks recognizing new models and the education between those two. And mentorship is an important part of that. So I was hoping you'd describe some of your experiences as each one of these paradigms shifted, and then some of your thoughts on new programs that you're bringing up to inculcate that and encourage that mentorship in the Navy of today.
Okay, yeah, I'd be delighted, and you're absolutely right. The time from graduation in 1981 throughout my XO tour was a bipolar world that we dealt in, and as a submariner, I was trained by the really hardcore Cold War submariners who knew their business, knew their boats, knew their weapons, knew their technology, and spent a lot of time at sea. I mean, those boats were quick turn and go back out, and it was all about, you know, the one major adversary in the bipolar world, us and the Soviet Union.
And one so ping, and one ping only.
That's right. That's what we trained to. You know, when we talked about order of battle, and we had our little cards to identify warships, it was all Russian warships. There were no other warships in that deck. You know, when you're on the periscope and you're looking out the scope and you see the silhouette and you're able to identify the Kinda or the Kashin or what have you. So that rapidly changed with the disintegration of the Soviet Union into the Russian Federation. And during the time that I was an Olmsted Scholar, 87 to 89, it was just before the wall came down, I wasn't able to travel to Eastern Europe, but I traveled all over Western Europe. And we had close allies and partners who depended on us. We had a heavy footprint over there. And that rapidly changed into what the nation thought would be a peace dividend, and we were going to draw down, and we were going to come home and garrison the force, and we suddenly dealt with other potential peer competitors on the horizon, and having to deal with multipolarity. And it wasn't just about you're on our team, NATO, or you're on the Warsaw Pact. Now there was this multiplicity and diversity of interests that the United States had to deal with. And when the Cold War ended, I was reading there was a 25th anniversary. I couldn't believe it, of Francis Fukuyama's The End of History. You know, history stopped because the Cold War was over. It really didn't. It got more complex. And frankly, the mission sets started to creep up. And instead of a peace dividend, we found ourselves doing more. We introduced ourselves to the concept of military operations other than war. MUTWA is what they used to call it, the acronym. And that was kind of something that grew into coalition operations, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. It all became very important. We wrote the maritime strategy. Peter Swartz and that team wrote it in 1986, and it was really all about one adversary. As we evolved in from the sea, forward from the sea, Sea Power 21, the cooperative strategy for the 21st century in 2007, that was 7 years ago, you saw this evolution take on kind of a different flavor. You know, it was, what can we do for others? What can we do with others? So that's coalition, humanitarian assistance, disaster relief. And then this third tranche, what's changed since the last time we wrote a maritime strategy? Well, there's a lot. We've gone through two land wars, and we're drawing down off two land wars, and those troops are coming home. We were, of course, attacked in 9/11, and that's been a decade-long struggle. As a result, we've been subject to several fiscal and budgetary pressures, and that led to the crisis in 2008, which culminated in, you know, what became sequestration a year ago. That put a lot of pressure, not just on the Navy, but all the services to be able to maintain readiness and force structure capacity and then modernization capability. We've seen the rise of peer competitors like China, and we've seen challenges in the Western Pacific. We went through a phase with the Russian Federation where we tried to make nice, and you see where that's led us with the current situation, very, very tense in the Ukraine. But we're still in the Black Sea, and we're still maintaining maintaining reassurance and solidarity with our allies there. There's a couple of new domains that we talk about in the air-sea battle concept, which weren't here in 2007, which are really important now. And that is cyberspace, and I would group cyberspace and electromagnetic warfare in the same, because they are very much the same. And then operations in space. We have a whole new set of capabilities that are coming online now. We talked about Admiral Klunder's directed energy systems, and we're going to test the laser out on USS Ponce for the first time later this year. You may have seen it on the nightly news about 6 months ago when it shot down a drone. It was very effective. And, you know, when you shoot that laser, you're paying for the electricity to fire that laser up. It's less than a buck a round, which is incredible and efficient. We've got the railgun coming online. We've got a whole new set of platforms of ships that are, they look different. They are different. They're manned different. We've got the mobile logistics platform, which I walked on board in San Diego, USS John Glenn, phenomenal platform, you know, capable of carrying LCACs and an incredible payload of things that we don't even know exist yet that we'll add later on, because it's all about payload over platform. MLP also has a version or a variant called the Mobile Logistics Platform, a float forward staging base, where we put a flight deck on these things. We can add special operations forces. We can add helicopters. We can add the V-22. You know, someday we may be able to put a V-STOL aircraft on that platform. We have the Littoral Combat Ship with modularity and anti-surface warfare, submarine warfare, and mine warfare, which is going to be a phenomenal platform. It's already out in Singapore. And we have the Joint High-Speed Vessel, which we intend to put a railgun on for a demo. And Spearhead just did a deployment through three combatant command AORs. So a heck of a lot has changed over those, you know, my 30 years, 32 years of commission service, if you broke it up into tranches of 10 years. And the fact that the Navy has been adaptable, flexible, there's still some core missions like, sea control, the security of the maritime commons, our presence out in places like the Western Pacific, and the things that we do with our allies in partnership that are enduring. And then there's other things that are new, as I mentioned, cyber and operations in space. And so lots of changes on the horizon.
And how, throughout your career, just to get us into that headspace of mentorship, you've mentioned Peter Schwartz, you mentioned 1986, you're talking about the maritime strategies. So you've seen at multiple points folks from different paradigms try to engage these different concepts of where the world is going. So maybe if you could give us a few vignettes on how you've seen naval officers come to terms, you know, engaging one another with these new concepts, and how you see that mentorship coming forward with your new program to have these different levels of officers engaging one another on strategy.
There's, you know, one thing I was doing some work in preparation for the current strategy forum the other day, and I recall this rather seminal piece that was done in proceedings. Couldn't remember the year, but I remember the title of the article. It was called Ring of Fire. And so as soon as you Google things nowadays, there's another game changer for you. Boom. It comes up with the name Lieutenant Commander Ross Mitchell, Proceedings 1997. And Ring of Fire was a concept that Mitchell came up with on how to use a battle group local area network that would allow launch on remote of Tomahawk land attack missiles from something like the Arsenal ship. Arsenal ship was a concept for a ship which was almost like a barge full of Tomahawks that would be self-propelled. It would go out there and operate either uniquely, a disaggregated way, or an aggregated way with a strike group, and it would be a force multiplier with a large inventory of weapons and many variants of that particular Tomahawk land attack missile. So Mitchell was looking for a way, and they experimented with this on USS Benfield, to launch a Tomahawk from remote on the bridge of the Benfield. And beyond that, how about if we are operating in consort with other Aegis ships who are conducting other special missions and focused on that mission, but we need to reach into their inventory and launch one of their weapons from a different platform. So it was a pretty cool idea and potentially a game changer. And elements of that have manifested themselves in the way we do network-centric warfare. So, you know, this guy, this lieutenant commander, writes this article. It goes viral. It gets a lot of attention all the way up to the CNO. And, you know, brilliant thinkers like Vice Admiral Frank Pandolf take note. And it just goes to show the power of innovative thinking and the power of our young officers. And so I'm trying to harness some of that, and I'm looking for guys like you or guys like guys and gals who are members of CNO's Rapid Innovation Cell. He's got that organization down in Norfolk, Virginia, under the umbrella of the Naval Warfare Doctrine Command, and these are young lieutenants. The CNO invited them to the last Navy Flag and SES conference and allowed them to present some of their projects. And, you know, this was like Trident Scholar work, brilliant stuff, things that have innovative applications in cyberspace. They were able to fast-track a 3D printer to the fleet. Now, you say, well, 3D printers are out there, so why is that so hard? Well, because we have a bureaucracy. It's called the acquisition program. And our acquisition development program, and it's really hard to get some of these things done. These guys figured out a way, and those 3D printers are out there. I believe they're out in the 5th Fleet AOR, and they're making parts on board ships. And that's something that has potentially universal applications in the Navy.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
I was going to say, as far as mentorship goes, did you want to talk about that?
Yes, sir.
I think what we're going to try to do is a spin-off at the current strategy forum. Is we'll have a few flags there in the audience, and I think mentorship is really important. How do you get the future Ross Mitchells of the world? How do you get some of these folks that are graduates of the Naval Strategy Program, or those JOs that aspire to be graduates of the program, on the right track with the right advice? Well, I think mentorship is the way to go, and so what I'd like to do is ask the community of senior officers, 06 and Flag, are you interested in being a mentor? And there's probably plenty of young officers out there like yourself and your contemporaries who would be interested in teaming up with these folks and not only getting a little bit of career advice, but also a couple of steers on, hey, have you thought about going to the Naval Postgraduate School? Have you thought about going to a Pole Mill Master's Program? Have you thought about going to the Naval War College? Have you thought about asking your detailer for this shore duty assignment? And I'll tell you, I had great mentors when I was growing up, and a couple of them were overseas when I was an Umstead scholar. You mentioned one, Peter Swartz. You know, while I was at the University of Strasbourg, I wrote this paper. It was at the time before the Cold War came down, and we were negotiating with the Russians on the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces Treaty. So we were going to give up our presence of Pershing 2s on the continent in order for the Russians to pull back some of their equivalent weapon systems. And this was all going to be good for peace and prosperity. The Europeans weren't so enamored with that. And even in the university environment, which was fairly liberal in France and in that region, maybe a little more conservative in Strasbourg than Paris, I was challenged by my professors on this because they knew I was a naval officer. I wore civilian clothes to school during that program. But they said that, you know, we were shirking our responsibilities. We were walking away from Europe. We were weakening NATO by engaging in this discussion with the Russians. And so it became part of one of my research papers on, well, what's the substitute for Pershing 2? And, you know, I wrote a paper about how TLAM, and at the time we had a couple of different variants of TLAM, and I'll leave it at that, could be an appropriate substitute because when launched from a submarine basket, you can get to many of the same places you could get to with a Pershing 2. Not exactly the same range rings, but, you know, pretty close. So I wrote this thing, and I mentioned it to the naval attaché in Paris, who was a submariner, Jay Highland. He says, how are you doing out there in Strasbourg in the hinterlands? And I said, oh, I'm working on this paper. He goes, send me a copy. So I sent it to him. He read it, and he goes, you ought to go talk to Peter Swartz. I was like, who's Peter Swartz? Well, Peter Swartz had finished writing the maritime strategy in 86. He got a dream assignment over in Brussels as a captain working in the NATO mission, which is where we have our NATO, our American ambassador to NATO. And so I wrote him a letter and I sent him a copy of my paper. And he wrote me back and he said, okay, read your paper. Why don't you get on a train and come for a visit? So I did. And when I got to the NATO headquarters, I walked in and Peter handed me a very impressive schedule card and said, here's your agenda for the day. Now, he had passed out my paper to, you know, 25 of his closest personal friends around NATO, and they all wanted to talk to me. And so I spent the day running around that building, which is it's like the Pentagon. It's hard to find places, talking to colonels and captains in the U.S. inventory, purple, and then a few foreign officers. And I got mixed responses from everybody. I remember one Air Force colonel told me he thought this was the stupidest idea he'd ever heard of. And others suggested that, hey, good idea. Have you thought about this? And at the end of the day, Peter introduced me to a legendary Dr. Larry Legere, who'd been a guy that jumped into Normandy during the invasion in World War II, you know, on D-Day. And he was a jump master for General Maxwell Taylor. Phenomenal guy, real gentleman. And octogenarian, but still, you know, very full of energy and perfect control of his faculties. Very strategic thinker. And I never forgot that deed or that day. I never forgot that. And I maintained my friendship with Peter Swartz since that day, and he's been a very close advisor to me. You know, as I've gone through different assignments, we bounce back and forth to Washington, and I see him all the time, and he's over at the Pentagon all the time, and we chat quite a bit, and he and his friends, Dick Diamond and Robbie Harris, two retired captains, have formed this strategy discussion group in town, which is a real force multiplier. So there's that, and I took that example and tried to do it myself. I mentor a couple of junior officers who are on active duty. You know, one of my favorite guys in the Navy, Lieutenant Mike Beer, is he worked for me as my EA over in Naples when I was Group 8. Mike's a surface warfare officer. He's the operations officer on Chung Hoon. He is doing a great job. He's finished the first half of his department head tour. He's done so well, they're going to send him off to Japan to be an OPSO on a fleet staff out there. And Lieutenant Commander Joe Guzman, who started off as a submariner, I met him when he was a midshipman on my first command, USS Oklahoma City. Joe went nuke power, and then after his commitment was up, he decided he'd like to do something different. So, you know, he asked. I gave him my advice. I said, you know, I think he's a Truman Scholar, a Marshall Scholar from the Naval Academy, Harvard guy, brilliant. I said, Joe, you know, what do you love? And, you know, he likes strategy. He likes traveling to places. He likes thinking. He likes complex things. I said, go be an intel officer. And he did. And he came back to me. He said, where should I go for my first assignment? They gave me three choices. I said, go forward. Go to the pointy end of the spear. Go to Djibouti. And he did. He did great. He was out there for over a year on an IA and came back and made lieutenant commander. So, you know, that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. You know, this is free advice for those who are interested, and it's my hope that, you know, someday Lieutenant Commander Guzman and Lieutenant Beer will be wearing flag rank and they'll be off doing the same thing for somebody else.
Now, I know time is getting short, so I want to close up. We've spoken a lot about sort of our process on our side, understanding and building our strategy. And Robert McNamara in the documentary Fog of War has a great point. He says, need to be able to empathize with your enemy. Not feel sorry for them, not agree with them, but be able to understand them. So the modern day adversary and many of our friends, so the strategic process is not just figuring out our house, but what's going on the other side of the aisle, or what's going on either side of us, the folks that we're standing shoulder to shoulder with. Maybe you can discuss a little bit, how do we develop, or how do you see us building a program in which we develop a better understanding of our friends and our adversaries and how they view problems and strategy?
Absolutely. And let me tell you that the finest program that's out there that's available for our young officers, and I just gave some advice to an officer on Chung Hoon and another officer that was out on USS Jacksonville who competed for the Olmsted Scholar Program, is that program. If you want to learn about, understanding the world through the lens of another culture and another nation. And General Olmsted, his philosophy was, in order to be effective as a fighting force, you've got to understand the enemy, potential adversaries, and you sure have to know who your friends are and how they think. And that was his charter. And when he got out of the Army and established a very successful investment bank and used those proceeds to stand up the Olmsted Scholar Program for the Department of Defense, and we shotgun about 19 folks all over the world now. That's grown over the years. And you go to foreign university for a couple of years after you've learned a language, and you get a degree, and you mix with foreign students. This isn't about, a debutante program where you're with other Americans. You are fully integrated into a foreign university. My classmates were French, Belgian, Dutch, who spoke French, and it was graduate level. Great way to do it. Why is that important? I'll tell you, I've had some dream assignments in my life. Probably my favorite shore tour of all, everybody wants to be in command at sea, but if you have to be back in the building here, I worked for Admiral Mike Mullen, who I think the world of as his EA when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs. And Admiral Mullen was a huge proponent of Dr. Stephen Covey, the Seven Habits. And before he passed away, Dr. Covey came in with his son, who's since taken over the business, and his daughter-in-law, for a chat with Admiral Mullen, because Admiral Mullen would ask him to talk to the flight community all the time. And never forget, Covey walks in, and he throws this thing, I'm holding one here in my office, on Mullen's desk, and he goes, Mike, I'd like you to have an Indian talking stick. And Admiral Mullen goes, well, what's that? And he goes, well, it's something that was made by Native Americans and used by Native Americans between tribes to reconcile their differences. And he goes, really, tell me more. He said, well, the simple rules of the Indian talking stick were, when you were in the teepee and you were with the chief of one tribe and the chief of another tribe and all the braves, and you were about to go to war over something, you try to talk it out first. And culturally, I think that's the way things work. And whoever possessed this talking stick had the floor. Nobody else could talk. That was rule number one. And rule number two was, while you possessed that stick, you had to present whatever the differences were, whatever the problem was, through the lens of the other tribe's eyes. So you had to say, well, if we got a territorial dispute, this is the way you think about it. And then they would represent it in the way that the other tribe thought about it. And once you did that, it was a lot easier to work out differences. And Covey said, I just come back from Jerusalem, where I had a worldwide conference on religion with members of the Jewish faith, the Muslim faith, and the Christian faith. And they all came into the conference center with talking points about why one of the three had done something to offend the other. And he goes, okay, put those away. We're going to use the Indian talking stick. And when you have the floor, you have the floor. But if you're Jewish, you have to represent the world in the problems in the Arab street through the Arab member or the Muslim member's eyes, and same thing for Christians and Arabs and Christians and Jews. And he said by the end of that weekend conference, everybody was high-fiving and hugging each other. They couldn't wait to do it again. And so there's a real value in that. One of the other lessons I learned from Admiral Mullen, my travels with him all over the world, I think we did 156 trips, 250,000 miles in every aircraft type model series, the inventory. Went down to Australia, and we met with Chief of Defense Angus Houston, who's now heading up the MH370 search effort. And Air Marshal Houston had a slide that he put up on the screen that Admiral Mullen loved. And it was a slide of Australia, you know, in the center of the Mercator projection with the rest of the world all around it. And Australia was just this big landmass surrounded by water, and the United States is up in the upper left, and it looks like, you know, one of the small islands in the Sulu Sea. And Admiral Mullen said, that's the way our Australian allies see the world. And he took that slide and he brought it back and he showed it to the flag community here. And goes, you know, you guys, when you go out there, you have to think about things in the way that our friends and allies and even our peer competitors and our adversaries look at the world. And he used to talk about that a lot with respect to the war in Iraq, the war in Afghanistan, and what was going on in Europe with the Russians. And I think that's very valuable. And, you know, we all can take a lesson from General Olmsted and Stephen Covey and Admiral Mullen in how to do that better.
Unfortunately, I know that your time is valuable here, and we are coming just a little bit over the time limit that we initially set. So I do want to release you back to your duties. But the one question I did get from someone at SIMSEC that I think is worth an answer. How do we trust you with strategy and operations when you go out and get a haircut at Fort Myers in your whites? That doesn't seem like really good decision. I'm just saying it's a lot of responsibility on the shoulders of a man who's in his whites getting his haircut.
Well, I tell you what, I have favorite barber who's probably been taking care of my hair for, 10 years now. Her name is Sandy. She's from South Korea. She's been up there. She used to cut General Pace's hair. She cuts General Campbell's hair, you know, and just a wonderful lady who does it right, takes her time. And we usually have a strategic discussion about things that are going on in the Pacific or on the Korean Peninsula. So that's why I go up there.
You know what? I have to bring this up. Back when I was at Georgetown, your story reminds me of this. I had a barber, Mr. Nguyen. Didn't know anything about him until one day I came in uniform. Starts telling me stories. He was a South Vietnamese Marine officer. And all he started doing was talking to me about the different kinds of ways that he recognized and engaged with the enemy. And I remember this story. It kind of reminds me of your vignettes, and I think you'll enjoy it. He talked about how they could recognize NVA and Viet Cong units by the kinds of weapons that they carried. So if you heard, you know, if you heard a crew serve weapon, it meant this many soldiers were with them. But they would switch it up to try to trick the South Vietnamese soldiers into thinking different sized units were out there. One day they're out in the jungle and they see a tank. They freak out. They're deep within friendly lines and here is a tank. They're thinking hundreds upon these guys have to be out here and there's about 10 of us. They launch a rocket at it, start running away, and the thing just explodes. They turn around. Some guy had taken a car and welded that sheet metal all over it, so in the jungle and in the shade, it would look like a tank. And I'm sitting here, and this is my normal barber, and I knew nothing about this man up until that point. And we're talking about strategy. You just talked about perspective, and you know, not just at NWDC, not at, you know, in a book on these programs that we all listen to. You know, these different podcasts and people we talk to who are strategic experts. Just everyday life. Talking with people, the experiences that they've had, and the perspectives they have from everything from their life to things you may not even know about them. So strategy is everywhere. And, you know, we talk about cultivating strategy and disseminating it. It's a rich, target-rich environment. And we just have to be able to dig into that. Admiral, before we go, we've talked about the CSF. We've talked about the mentorship programs that you're trying to set up, the subcategories or sub-designators for officers, and the different speakers in their books. Is there anything that you would like to plug before we close up today's show?
Well, like I said, I want to harness the energy of the future Lieutenant Commander Ross Mitchells and the future Lieutenant Matt Hipples out there. And so I reach out through your podcast to all those bright young men and women who make up, the core of the United States Navy, the Lieutenant JGs, the Lieutenants, and the Lieutenant Commanders. I'm happy to hear from you, and I look for your ideas. I went out and did a a stint at the Naval Postgraduate School before I took my job at N81. It was just a couple of days familiarity, and we crammed it with all sorts of classes and books and had a chance to talk with people at Google. And one of the guys at Google got up and said, well, there's a theory out there that you can't innovate if you're over 30. I said, man, I'm really out of luck then. I gotta rely on people like you, Matt, to help me out with that. So, you know, I look for your guidance and your ideas and frankly your leadership, because what you do with your blog and your podcast and all your other publications is really leading the United States Navy forward. And we need more of that, and I encourage that. And since you mentioned it, I gotta tell you this one. If you got time, I got to tell you the quick.
I got time, sir. No problem.
You talk about Vietnam and that Barbara Nguyen that you met, who was a former South Vietnamese Marine. Yeah, this is another benefit of having worked for Admiral Mullen. Is one day, you know, the author of We Were Soldiers Once and Young, Joe Galloway, came in, and he had a sit-down session with Admiral Mullen because Admiral Mullen wanted to understand more about the Army. You know, it wasn't just knowing about the Allies or peer competitors or the Russians or the Chinese. He had to know about the other services.
Yeah, back to that topic of interdependence we were talking about earlier. Absolutely.
Exactly. So Galloway came in, and Galloway brought his book. And while I was sitting in the outer office, I was chatting with him. And he told me the story about General Hal Moore, who's the subject of the book, of course, in this great battle with the Vietnamese. And when he wrote the book, he gave Moore a copy, and Moore said, Joe, one of these days, you and I are going to go back to that place, and we're going to visit it. And sure enough, you know, the Vietnam War ended, and after a while, you know, things opened up so that Americans could go back and you can get a passport. Now we have diplomatic relations, and just about a week ago, USS John S. McCain, you know, went into Camaran Bay, I think, and flying not only the U.S. flag, but Vietnamese flag from the yardarm. So we've come full circle. Well, Galloway told me they did go back, and the Vietnamese were very gracious to them because they knew that General Moore was highly revered and a very capable soldier. And so they wanted to receive him with all due respect. And so they brought the commander in of the Vietnamese forces that he was fighting against. And they spent the entire day together, and then they flew them out in a helicopter to the battlefield. And they walked the battlefield all day, and they talked about each individual's decision and maneuver on the battlefield as they fought to try to kill one another years before. And they found out that they had very similar career paths, that they had risen through the ranks and similar you know, career schools and training and commands and milestones, and that although a culture and a language and at one time a uniform and enmity separated them, they were a lot alike. And then Galloway said something really eerie happened, and that was, you know, it was a monsoon season or whatever, but the rain set in and they couldn't get the helicopter off the ground, so they stayed the night, you know, and he sat there with Moore, I don't think they could sleep. They were so keyed up, and, you know, this place brought back so many memories. But, you know, again, wouldn't it have been nice if we could have figured that out before we actually went to war with the individuals that we were fighting. And the way it's turned out now is quite a turnaround, and we'll see where it all ends up. But, you know, I have high hopes for that particular country and our relationship with them in the future. So with that, I'll say, Matt, thank you very much.
And, thank you, sir.
I look forward to hearing from you again and all your friends. I look forward to seeing you at the Current Strategy Forum.
Absolutely, sir. Have a great day.
All right.
Thank you much. Yes, sir.
Do you enjoy sea control? We certainly hope you do. The Center for International Maritime Security is dedicated to bringing you the unique insights and perspectives that you've come to expect, and bring you back every week to our Sea Control podcast, the Next War blog, and our regular meetups. Becoming a member is easy. Go to www.cimsec.org/about/membership to get our articles via email and receive a WordPress account that allows you to submit your own material. We're here to expand the dialogue, so don't be shy about submitting your own podcast topics or blog articles. Don't forget to support the podcast by leaving a comment, a 5-star rating, and tell all of your friends. We appreciate it.